school, became the first female guide at Formosa National Park. She's now pursuing a degree at Boise State University, which is why we're fortunate to have her here to share with us more of her experience. So, here you go, Gabby.
Hello, can you guys hear me in the back? Sorry. My name is Gabby, and I'm from Mozambique, as she said. And I'm here today just to share a little bit about the restoration project of Gorgoza National Park in Mozambique. I am from Mozambique, one of the 54 nations of Africa continent, located in the southeast coastline of Indian Ocean. This is Gorongosa National Park in central area of Mozambique. We almost lost our treasure national park. You can imagine, I was born in 1999. There was nothing left in that park when I was born. A lot of animals were killed, either for food, in case of elephant, or the ivory. We had turbulent history in my country. Colonialism, we had 16 years of civil war, political disability right in my town, so we had a lot. And this is a picture of how we lost our animals during the civil war. There were huntings going on in the park and many other things. Imagine if a Yellowstone was suddenly devastated in a second. No animals, no trees. How would you feel? Sad, of course. But what if someone brought back the whole animals in Yellowstone National Park? How you would feel? Happy and proud of your in the Yellowstone Treasure National Park. After the Civil War, many efforts were made to restore Gorongosa National Park, but they were incomplete until 2004. An Idahoan philanthropist, Greg Carr, joined the government of Mozambique to restore Gorongosa National Park. In restoration project, he first reintroduced herbivores like elephants, buffaloes, blue wildebeest, sables, impalas, hippopotamus, painted wolf dogs. We recently reintroduced painted wolf dogs, hyenas, spotted hyenas, leopards, and our lion population has grown fast in the last years. We now have approximately 500 lions in our national park. Gorongosa Park now has large animals, small animals, trees that communicate the miracle of existence of our national park. But one thing, what about the people that live next to Gorongosa National Park? Gorongosa National Park is the largest employer in the central area of Mozambique. 98% of our employees are Mozambican, and the higher majority are from local communities. We recently trained first female rangers of Gorongosa National Park. We also help our community, our system. We want to our next door community to have a good sustainability and green economy. So we also provide training, sustainability for farmers. And from famous shade and grown coffee on Mount Gorongosa to restore and rainforest and also to provide sustainability to our community. We also conduct some other projects like honey projects. fish ponds. We have a wheat craft. We have a lot of cashew and many other sustainable programs. So our honey project, so here is the park and here is a community across the river. And we have animals like elephants that cross the river and go to a community called Vino. It crops of the farmers and many other things. So in ecologist, elephant ecologist Dominique Gonçalves, with other park scientists, are working to mitigate the human-wildlife coexistence. And at the same time, the park buys honey from the community and provide sustainability in both sides. Gorongosa Park also has an education program. And we have girls clubs that helps keep teen girls in school and out of child marriage. As you know, in African nations countries, a lot of girls are not allowed to go to school and they get married in the early ages, like 14, 15. So Gorongosa National Park is providing education for girls, and we have about 2,000 girls in school now. As well, Gorongosa Park provides built schools to, we recently in Mozambique have experienced tropical cyclones. And one of them was in 2019, called Cyclone Idai. That was very devastating. And Gorongosa National Park is building schools to ameliorate the situation, school that will last longer in case of any natural disasters come. So Gorongosa National Park building school to the community next door. And as well built school, hospitals to the communities. And I'm a Boise State student, major in business, and I'm a junior, probably next year be graduating. I've been 3 years now. I'm not adjusted with the weather. But it's fun to be here and learning different cultures, because I can take a lot of experience from people in my village. And I think one thing that Idaho has shown me is the value of being among different people, the value of being in Idaho that we also share in Mozambique. We love to be Mozambique, and we love to be surrounded people. We love to learn, and many all other these great things that Idaho and Boise State in a university that is a international community is being shown, taught me how to be surrounded people. And I've been learning quite few things, join Polar Club and a lot of crazy things, but one thing that I'm gonna take and is to work together. We are all here today to listen from different experience perspective to be able to solve upcoming problems or recent problems. So how we overcome this problem, how we work together. We have to learn to work together so that we solve the problems. We have to take our differences away, say, let's work together for climate change. Let's work together to bring the world back in our ecosystem. That's what we want, and that's how the world should be, working together as one. Thank you.
Thank you. referral for other parks, for other types of relationships with the community around it?
Yes. So, Gorongosa National Park is known now as one of the greatest restoration projects in Africa, and we have even our national parks are implementing, for example, we are the first, I think, from now on, going to reintroduce the rangers, female rangers in the park. So basically, a lot of other national parks in Mozambique, they are training Mozambican rangers and Mozambican scientists so that they are able to take care of it. So we are being an example, not outside, but inside of our country too.
We have one more question.
Gabby, could you say a little bit more about the girls' clubs of Gorongosa and what those mean to the people in the buffer area?
Yes. So we have a girls' club programs that now are about 2,000 girls in school. So as I said, a lot of girls get married in early ages. So Gorongosa National Park has this program in each school. So Gorongosa Park is surrounded by 6 districts, and there are some communities that are very close to the park, like Eshobinho, Pepeberu, and more. So our park is providing education. So the girls go in the club, they have a tutor for math, Portuguese, because we were colonized by Portugal, by Portuguese, so we speak Portuguese. And they learn, we speak Portuguese because in the local communities, they learn the first language is the Bantu language, like Senandao, in, well, different areas. So we have girls that are in clubs. It depends, in one club, you can find 50 girls or 25 girls in one club with 2 tutors, teaching them in Portuguese, math, social skills, and more. So they divide the girls that when go to school in the afternoon, they go to club in the morning, and vice versa with other girls. And we now have the same girls after they finish their high school. They have choice, they can make choice, work to the park or going to pursue other degrees like university. So we have, I think the last year, we trained 200 girls in agriculture, other girls windcraft, other decided to be a teacher, they're in teaching school, and other girls are in nursing school right now. So we have these programs that keep girls in the school. And as well, we have a youth club. So the youth club is a different thing. It's boys and girls in the same club, learning the social skills and math skills and all other things there in different groups. So
it's more, it's what Gorongosa does with the Girl Squad. Thank you so much, Abby. We really appreciate you taking the time out to talk with us today.
Thank you.
I'll take just a minute to pull up the next presentation. the International, or sorry, the Intermountain Bird Observatory here at Boise State, where his work helps advance the science on bird migration. The observatory staff is quick to point out that birds do not stop at borders, and neither does their work. And so Greg is here to tell you about his work with African vultures as part of the restoration effort at Warren Rosa National.
Thank you, and I'm glad everybody can be here this afternoon. Thank you for inviting me to speak. I'm a staff member here at Boise State University. I'm on the faculty. I started working in Gorongosa National Park 6 or 8 years ago, and listening to a lot of the talks today, and being a scientist, sometimes it's really hard to be positive, isn't it? It's hard to be it's hard not to be depressed about all of the environmental calamities going on all around us, all over the world. And I teach a fisheries and wildlife management course here at Boise State University. It's hard to stay positive for my students, but I will say, you know, one bright spot, one fantastic thing that's happening is this huge scale restoration, this beautiful work that's going on at Gorongosa National Park. So I want to talk to you today real briefly about another one of these environmental disasters that's happening, and that is the decline in African vultures. So I started working at Gorongosa National Park to try and further the conservation of some critically endangered vulture species. It turns out that the majority of vultures now on the African continent are in decline, some of them up to 80 to 90% declines in their population. Several of these species occur at Gorongosa National Park. There was a paper, recent scientific paper, not too many years ago, that pointed out this decline, and there was an immediate response by the IUCN to uplist many of these species to endangered and some even critically endangered. The species that can be found in Mozambique are the white-backed vulture up there, the top left, Rapel's vulture, the white-headed vulture, the bottom left, and the hooded vulture. There are other species as well, the lapid face on the left there, Egyptian vulture, and many others that are really in serious decline across Africa. You can see how many of them have been, you know, recently uplifted just within the last decade by the IUCN. And so there are many reasons that these vulture populations are in decline. One of them is what we call retaliatory poisoning. Say you're a farmer and a lion comes in and kills your livestock. Oftentimes what happens is they'll take one of those carcasses, they'll poison that carcass in an effort to try and kill the lion. Other predators and scavengers come in, feed on that poisoned carcass, and end up dying. For a long time, there has been mortality, there's been harvest due to faith or belief-based uses of these parts, these vulture parts. Just like here in North America, there's also a problem with lead poisoning. These birds scavenging, foraging on carcasses that have been shot with lead bullets. And so there are lead fragments left in those carcasses. These birds are very susceptible to lead poisoning. Also, as power infrastructure, you know, grows on the continent, there are more electrocutions and more collisions and things like that with power infrastructure. But really, probably the greatest threat to these vultures is intentional poisoning. It's what we call sentinel poisoning. And if you're a poacher and you've just killed an elephant, or a rhino, what's the first thing that happens? A bunch of vultures come over the carcass and begin to soar. And that points out to the authorities, to the rangers, exactly where that kill has occurred. And so on a very, very large scale, poisoning is occurring to try and kill vultures to aid poachers, really, to aid poachers. And this This has resulted in massive, massive kills, hundreds, even more than, you know, 1,000 vultures at a time. And so we set out to begin studying a couple of these species that occur and are still very, very common at Bouragosa National Park there in Mozambique. We're looking at the biology to try and further conservation of white-headed and white-backed vultures there. We're doing that in a number of ways. We're trying to evaluate their populations. We're using satellite technology to track their movements, and we are also monitoring their nest sites. Some of these species, there's so little known about them because there are so few left in the wild that where you do find a stronghold like Bouragosa National Park, it's very important, I think, to actually study and learn their basic nesting, you know, nesting biology. And so we have tracked vultures now for about the last 6 or 7 years to try and identify threats, try and identify mortality factors for these birds. And we have found some very interesting things. On the left is that's an image of the movements of white-headed vultures that were tagged in the park. And the interesting thing is the vast majority of them, they almost know the park boundaries. They almost never go outside the park. When they do, it's true. They almost never go outside the boundaries of the protected area. But when they do, it's to feed on abundant food resources. Going out here to the left, out there by Chamoyo, there is an abattoir. And they're certainly a threat of being poisoned, you know, there when they do go outside the park boundaries. White-backed vultures show a completely opposite pattern. Bouragosa is home to, you know, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of white-backed vulture nests. And this species travels very, very wide and far, making movements of thousands of kilometers and crossing international borders. So the park, it may serve as a, you know, a breeding ground for this species in Southeast Africa, these birds, when they move outside the park, they certainly are threatened by running into these various, you know, mortality factors. So you may be thinking, you know, so what? Why are vultures important? It turns out, you know, that vultures, what they do in terms of a service to us, an ecological service, is that they remove carcasses from the wild, and they do that very, very rapidly. I've watched this with my own eyes. A group of vultures can come in and completely remove a carcass, everything except the bones, within just a few minutes. And so, in the absence of vultures, unfortunately, those carcasses sit there for a number of days, even weeks. They actually they dry out, and this becomes a reservoir for all kinds of different diseases. And so, vultures can remove carcasses very quickly. Without vultures, what we find is that those carcasses persist. They become diseased. And that becomes a human threat. In India, where there was another vulture decline of up to 99% of all vultures, they were actually replaced in terms of ecological function by wild dogs. And wild dogs carry rabies. They end up biting people. People get rabies. It ends up costing the Indian government dollars a year. A study was done to look at exactly how much, you know, a vulture is worth. If you look at those costs, those medical costs without vultures in the system, and it's somewhere more than $10,000 for each bird. And that's not to mention their value to us as well, in terms of tourism and just appreciation, you know, having them on the landscape. So, anyway, I hate to depress you even more talking about another environmental disaster that's happening, but there is some hope, I think. There are many, many changes being made, a lot of training happening to be able to go into these poisoning sites quickly and stop the poisoning from occurring and removing the poisons from the from the environment. And so I'll just run through some photos real quickly of our work there. We were using a drone to monitor nests and collect nests, very specific nest site information for these beautiful white-headed vultures. In my opinion, I'm a raptor biologist by training. Boise State University has the only master's program in the world that focuses specifically on raptor biology. And I've traveled all over the world. I've never seen a more beautiful raptor than these white-headed vultures. We've also done as much mentoring of local students, Mozambican students, as we can to try and get them interested in vultures, interested in conservation of vultures, and other birds at the park as well. This has been very successful, in my opinion, as well as promoting ecotourism there, really just trying to get the word out, especially here in Boise and within Idaho, about the work that's going on there at Gorongosa in Mozambique and about the connection between Idaho and Gorongosa. So I don't have much time, but I'll kind of end up just with some photos of how we do this work there. We attract these vultures in to a trapping station using a carcass. This is a feeding gathering of vultures here. It's amazing when you might not see any up in the sky. Put out a carcass, you start to come into this carcass, and then all of a sudden, 50 vultures show up within just a few minutes. Just seemingly coming out of thin air. It's really quite a feeding frenzy that happens. This is why they can remove a carcass in just a few minutes. A handmade trap, kind of a leg noose. Once we have the bird in the hand, they're definitely not easy to handle, and they're not gentle either. But I guess I wouldn't be either. Takes about a half an hour to affix this radio transmitter, and that allows us, honestly, to come back here to Idaho and track their movements. We get readings every 30 minutes on their location, their altitude, their speed. And I guess I'll leave it at that with just a few pretty pictures. I'm happy to answer any questions you guys might have. And thanks again for inviting me.
Hi, thanks for the talk. My name is James Deneen. I'm a reporter with New Scientist. I was struck that so many of the threats to vultures are related to poaching other animals or threats that would also threaten other animals. Do you think what happens with vultures could be an indicator for the sort of like health and direction of wider ecosystems across the wider region?
I guess I'm not quite understanding. I mean, vultures, like many raptors, are top-level predators. They're actually scavengers. But yes, I mean, the fact that they're declining is certainly an indication of overall ecosystem health. But are you talking more about, like, attitudinous?
The first, what you said made sense. I guess, I mean, if we were to start to see vulture populations growing in a sort of positive direction, would that suggest a larger positive trend for other species as well?
Yes, I think it would. I think that, honestly, the majority of those mortality factors, though they are increasing, the biggest one by far is the intentional poisoning. The intentional poisoning of hundreds at a time. That's what's really kicking this decline into high gear. I think the others are probably mitigated for. Many of them have been on the landscape for hundreds of years, if not thousands.
Okay, we're going to do one more.
Hi, my name is Kim Oglesby. I'm a student and a freelance environmental justice reporter. My question really is that I think the ecotourism slide for some reason just stuck in my head as something that you're pushing and promoting, and I'm just wondering if you can break down a bit more the benefits and potential costs of ecotourism, understanding that at least in the examples I've seen in other parts of the world, a lot of communities have not liked that as a source of revenue for the communities, given the environmental harms, the colonization aspects of it.
I guess there are probably others, maybe in this room, that can speak more intelligently about the efforts at Borgosa Park to promote ecotourism. Our efforts were really to promote ecotourism in terms of birds and birding at the park. But I'm a firm believer in raising awareness about these conservation issues and about these species by inviting people to come see them and trying to instill in people the value of these animals, right? The value of the animals in your natural environment and their services, I guess, what they provide for us, you know, and pretty cool. I mean, really, an African experience, if you're going there to see big mammals, big fly, you see vultures, I mean, that's part of your experience there. And so, I'm all about promoting, you know, others from around the world to come experience, see, and appreciate these resources as a way of promoting conservation.
Thank you so much. I know there are more questions for Greg. He's based here at Boise State, and also I think you're a speaker on one of the field trips tomorrow. Is that right?
I am, yes.
All right, so.
No vultures.
but maybe there'll be some discussion of the Modus Towers. Another cool topic for everyone to dig into.
Yes.
All right, I'm going to switch us over to the last lunchtime presentation.
Share some examples of how journalists have used GFW data in their storytelling. Yes, and feel free to come to the deeper dive at 4 p.m. if you'd like to learn a little bit more of what the website looks like and how to actually do some of the things that I'll be talking about. So Global Forest Watch is a fully interactive and publicly available online forest monitoring data platform designed to empower experts and non-experts alike to access and analyze spatial data for forest protection. And our work is built around the idea that data and tools should be transparent and support our audience of journalists, government officials, civil society organizations, communities, researchers, many others to use this information to enact policies for sustainable forest management, be held accountable to global commitments, and improve supply chains and support forest defenders, ultimately leading to better outcomes for forests. So in short, we offer the latest cutting-edge technology to empower people to better protect forests. So one of the things we like to emphasize is that Global Forest Watch is a global and growing partnership, and our partners range from corporations, as we help them reduce deforestation in their supply chains, and to storytelling partnerships like the one that we have with environmental journalist group Mongo Bay. Global Forest Watch works very closely with the media to provide access to trustworthy and data and expert analysis. For example, every year we release the global tree cover loss data, and prior to the launch we work with over 50 journalist organizations to share the story behind the data. And just 1 month after the launch, we had been featured in media outlets over 1,400 times. So Global Forest Watch works with global and local reporting groups. For example, Reporter Brazil is a great local example that works to tackle human rights and violations in supply chains and workplaces across Brazil. Some of the publications highlight the proposed bills to open Brazilian indigenous lands to environmentally destructive practices such as mining and dams and cattle ranching. So when writing this article featured on the slide, Reporter Brazil got in touch with Global Forest Watch and to interview experts on the state of the forest within this indigenous area to include information about the threats from mining activity. So the article included images featured on the slide of Global Forest Watch data on tree cover loss threatening the indigenous area and the proposed mining concessions, all accessible on the website. For a more global example, the Washington Post wrote a piece about Global Forest Watch's analysis of the 2021 tree cover loss data, and they used the GFW data to show how fires had accounted for more than a third of the world's tree cover loss in that year, the largest share on record. So preparation for pieces like these is a little different since the annual tree cover loss data are under embargo before the launch. And a couple weeks before the launch, we hold a press conference with select journalists to share the embargoed data, allowing journalists enough time to prepare a story in advance, talk with our experts, and create original graphics explaining the data, such as the country trends and images shown here. So in addition to the annual tree cover loss data, another main data offer Global Forest Watch provides are the satellite-based near real-time deforestation alerts, which indicate where forest change is occurring as soon as the satellite detects it. So after forest change is detected and this becomes an alert, the alerts are prioritized based on their intersection with contextual data on Global Forest Watch. With high-resolution imagery, users can get an idea of some of the drivers and the context behind forest change. And we surface the data, but it doesn't stop there. Our users can then go and forest monitors can act on alerts and report activity to authorities, and our audience of journalists can communicate what's happening and lead to impact to reduce deforestation. So some of the capabilities of Global Forest Watch include allowing users to investigate an area on the map and that's experiencing recent forest change and run an analysis to return the number of alerts detected, the area that it covers during a time range. The alerts are downloadable as coordinates. And if there's an interest in learning more about the specifics, I can dive in during the workshop later this afternoon. And so one of the greatest benefits of the alerts of the platform is the ability to subscribe to get an email notification of when forest change happens as soon as the satellite detects it. And some of the visual functions of Global Forest Watch include the ability to play an animation of alerts as they're detected over time, which can be turned into a GIF displaying road development through a protected area, for example. Users can also share a link to a map view to share with authorities, include other contextual data sets that we host, and they can embed a map of alerts into an article or a website. So some of the contextual data, for example, that GFW surfaces for spatial data related to biodiversity includes the key biodiversity areas from BirdLife International and sites in the Alliance for Zero Extinction. So users can actually analyze tree cover loss within these regions, the spatial delineations of these biodiversity areas. And we're always updating the data sets that we have on Global Forest Watch and look to improve our data offer based on the latest research. So we're always looking to incorporate the latest and greatest of spatial data. So two main ways that journalists use Global Forest Watch include accessing GFW data for an ongoing story or a report that they're writing, or to generate story ideas by using our data. And I'll give a brief overview of each of these. So the main way is to support their story that they're already investigating with data. And they can find easily accessible statistics on forest loss within their area of interest. They can download graphs or generate graphs of tree cover loss by country level, province level, within a protected area or a custom area of interest, for example. These are available on something we call the dashboards, and I'll demonstrate how the dashboards can provide these automatically generated graphs and visuals later today. And I'll also show some of the handy features on the map, such as the ability to analyze an area for trends just by clicking the map and subscribing to get notified of change of recent forest loss or fire from the fire alerts. And also talk about the Global Forest Review, which is the go-to communications resource that is generated by experts to extract insights from the annual tree cover loss data, give metrics like the top 10 lists for countries who lost the most forest in the last year, for example. So when journalists use Global Forest Watch to generate story ideas, they often use the near real-time data on forest change and maybe intersect it with our contextual data sets that I've mentioned. There are a ton of data sets available, and I suggest just poking around the website to explore what kinds of information that we provide. Another sort of initiative that we have is a partnership with Manga Bay to what we call the Places to Watch initiative. In this example, we have it's basically data for impact, and we run an algorithm that takes the latest month of deforestation alerts and intersects them with protected areas and intact forest landscapes. Myself and other GFW staff do a dive into these locations across the tropics and highlight some of the top locations to send to Manga Bay to give, you know, ideas for their investigative reporting, so they can dive right in and look to see if they have on-the-ground contacts and can do some further investigation into what might be causing forest change in these locations. And the goal is to get this information into the hands of journalists who can sound the alarm on new frontiers of deforestation and really inspire intervention. So here's a quick example of what the map looks like, where we feature the stories that were written in direct response to Global Forest Watch data. And then pairing high resolution imagery with these points on the map can paint an interesting and informative picture of what is happening around the world. So these are the Manga Bay articles that were inspired by the alerts that fell into this protected area. So I'll just talk about some user stories real quick. I think I'll wrap it up soon. We have a mobile application called Forest Watcher, which allows users to take the data offline.